You are listening to the Cycling Podcast Femina, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Orla Shinawi.
Hello.
And a bit of a delay there, Orla.
Well, do we have a delay on the line? I don't know. There was a delayed response to you. I thought, was I supposed to give more than a hello? Hello!
Did you maybe expect more after your name?
Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I thought it was...
A list of achievements.
Well, something, anything, a bit of love, former, a bit of appreciation.
Okay, former All-Ireland triple jump record holder. And
that'll
Rose
do,
Manley.
Yes, woo.
Woo woo.
Well, how are you both? We're into May. We've made it to May.
Yes, another month
We've
done.
Made it to
well,
May.
Only just about. Only just about.
We're all surviving, aren't we? Everyone's healthy, everyone's well, everyone's safe. Has to be the only
yes,
thing that matters.
Absolutely. And in this month's episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina, we are turning our attention to the world's best female rider. She is the world's best female rider, isn't she? I don't think there can be any real debate about that, can there?
You're asking for one.
We're not debating it.
Otherwise, the whole episode falls down. So,
yeah. Before we've even started,
it's too late. It's too late to change now. It's Annemiek van Vleuten, the world road race champion, former world time trial champion,
two times.
Multiple winner. Well, yeah, we'll hear from her. We'll hear from her coach, Louis Delahaye. We'll hear from a teammate. We'll hear from a rival. All in the course of this month's episode. What have you been up to otherwise, ladies, before we get into the subject of Annemiek van Vleuten?
Oh man, my life is so unbroadcast worthy right now. I've been 24/7 parenting. That's it. That's it. Looking
no, you've,
after the
you've
kids.
had a dramatic bike crash.
Oh, I have. I was going to keep that in the lowdown, but I have. Yeah, I was knocked off my bike by a scooter. That was pretty dramatic, but not a highlight, I wouldn't say, of my last week.
No, I just asked what you've been up to.
Down to the ground. Yeah, I got knocked off my bike sideways by a hit and run scooter. But unfortunately for him, I've got his number plate and I've got a meeting with a police on Saturday. So whoever you are, I'm coming after you, Buster, with your smashed windscreen.
If you're listening, pal, the egg timer is running. What about you, Rose?
Come for you.
Well, I feel like now I'm going to... Well, I don't know what I did last week, but this week I'm going to start planning some vigilante action down in Amsterdam, going after this, whoever this scooter driver is. That's my next plan. That would be quite exciting.
Well, he smashed his windscreen. He shouldn't be that difficult to find, I reckon.
Oh, this is going to be great. This is the kind of tension and drama that we've been lacking from not having any sport.
It's like cereal.
Yeah.
Did you hurt
yourself, Orla?
Hugely, yes. I didn't break anything, miraculously. My body took the whole brunt of the fall, so my head didn't even touch the ground, I don't think. Obviously, I was wearing a helmet anyway. But yeah, huge bruise on my hip, my elbow. I've got a little tear in my lovely Castelli jacket. And I just felt winded and literally knocked over it's been a week now. Pretty much most of the week. So whiplash, the works. Yeah.
Have you been doing a bit of cycling?
I have been. Well, the thing is, I'm doing a lot of recreational cycling because here, I've said before, but we are not only allowed out, we're encouraged out. We're encouraged to ride. This is like, I think it was the night after the Prime Minister gave his latest update on what the situation was. And one of the first things he said was, it's really important for the people of Netherlands. We've got to go out running. We've got to go out cycling. We've got to go out hiking. And I was like, yeah, Rotta, I'm with you, out of my bike. But I have actually been cycling quite a lot just for sanity more than anything else. I'm doing a lot of leisure riding with the kids. So I'm taking them out every day to try to find quiet places around the city or outside of the city for them to run around. Getting on my road bike whenever I can. So I've had quite lovely, I don't call it lockdown here. It's not a lockdown, but self-isolation period. It's not been too bad. But I haven't been back on my road bike, obviously, since then, unfortunately. But I did get straight back on my family bike the very next day, rode for an hour on that because I thought I'm not letting those what's a polite way of describing them? Those
hoodlums.
Hoodlums. I'm not letting those hoodlums win. Yeah. But Rose, you were saying what you're doing.
I'm in a seaside lockdown and I have been for, several months. Well, yeah, probably is several months.
It is.
A couple of months. I think it's a couple of months now. I haven't been up to anything. Time just seems to float by, doesn't it? It just seems to just disappear and I don't feel like I've done anything at all. That's all I've got to say. Shall we move on?
You're surviving. That's an act of existence in itself.
Having heard Orla's amazing interview with Annemiek, which we will hear, but before that there was a little preamble where Annemiek was recommending to you all of that a Dutch TV show called Farmer Wants a Wife, which we're pretty sure, as we are reality TV experts, Richard, there was a British version. So maybe I'll spend some time looking for archive versions of Farmer Wants a Wife, and that's what I'll do this week.
Or you can watch the Dutch version on NPO1. I don't know if they do English subtitles, but you can give it a go. Boer Zoekt Vrouw is what it's called in Dutch, and it's well worth a watch.
I don't think I think it's probably one of those programs where you don't need subtitles. You get the gist of it.
There's a lot of mooing, a lot of lovesick guys. Yeah.
You do get some programs, don't you, where it has subtitles like cattle says moo, or cow says moo even.
I don't know what you watch, but yeah. We'll take your word for it, Richard.
Yeah, anyway, enough about that. What have we got in? We're just going to do a very brief news roundup, aren't we? Because there are one or two stories that we should touch on before we get onto the subject of Annemiek van Vleuten.
Yes, very brief news roundup. And once again, apologies for not being entirely upbeat, but we've got brilliant upbeat interviews to come. First of all, rather horrible news for Bigla Katusha. Both their title sponsors have withdrawn funding. Bigla has been in the sport since 2005, of course. They've been a UCI top 10 squad since 2015. So sad and worrying news for the sport, I would say. The team management have asked the UCI for access to its bank guarantee to pay staff and riders for April. So the bank guarantee, if you don't know, is a percentage of the team's overall budget that's put into a blocked account when the team is registered. It's supposed to protect the riders' rights to be paid if the team doesn't comply with regulations. So they've applied for that. No word as yet whether the UCI will free that money up or not. Elsewhere, the UCI has come under a bit of criticism for initially at least leaving women off its seemingly exciting announcement about a potential new race calendar for the second half of the year. I mean, that announcement now looks a little bit premature anyway, but the UCI didn't include women's cycling when it put forward its proposed new racing schedule back in April and said that the women would have to wait until the 15th of May. The Cyclist Alliance then wrote an open letter to the UCI calling for them to engage with the TCA and its riders on any revised calendar. Saying that the riders had yet to be consulted on anything to do with the corona discussions. The UCI have since said they are consulting on the matter, but with the CPA and Unio, the Union of Teams, rather than the TCA. But I think they'll be happy enough if there's any rider consultation at all. And finally, the UCI Ethics Commission has found HealthMate CycleLive team manager Patrick Van Hansen guilty of violations of its code of ethics. That's the multiple complaint abuse case that began over a year ago, and sanctions against Van Hansen are now being considered.
Well, Orla, you mentioned the sad news about Bigla Katusha. I noticed tonight, actually, they've launched a crowdfunding appeal as well to keep the team going in 2020. And Lizzie Banks, of course, is a Bigla Katusha rider, also presents Service Course for the Cycling Podcast. We'll hear from her a bit later on about Annemiek van Vleuten, but I also asked her, of course, about the news concerning her team. So, Lizzie, we got the news last week about the team and both sponsors, both main sponsors apparently pulling out. How did you hear about this news? Has this been brewing for a few weeks?
So the team have actually been really good and they've kept us fully informed of the situation at all times. And so we already knew about the situation with Katusha, and then we were a little bit surprised to hear about the situation with Bigla. So we found out the day before the press release. And it was a bit of a shock. But to be honest, I think the team have been amazing and they've handled it so well. They have all paid all our salaries fully up till now, and they have every intention to try and keep paying our salaries. They have created an action plan to unlock the UCI bank guarantee to enable them to keep paying the salaries and also to have enough money put aside so that once the racing does resume, the team is able to you know, transport the riders and pay for the hotels and things like that.
And you published a letter as a team over the weekend, which was very, very impressive and powerful. And it showed a sort of togetherness. There's obviously among you riders a determination to keep the band together.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the letter was quite indicative of the way we race. You know, we race as a team and we are in this together. We have a fantastic group of riders this year. And we proved that in the races that we've had. We've had very few races this season, but the team has already accumulated 4 wins, a few more podiums. And I think we've been top 10 in every race we've done. So, I mean, if that doesn't speak volumes about the quality of the team and the fact that we punch above our weight, then I'm not quite sure what does.
I mean, it's hard enough at the moment for riders to, you know, train and keep their motivation. How much more difficult does this make it just to keep training, to keep focused and motivated when you don't know when you'll race again and you've got this uncertainty now around your team as well?
To be honest, I've not struggled too much with motivation to train. The weather's been pretty nice here for the past couple of weeks, which has really helped. So I've just really enjoyed getting outside and being able to. And I think the fact that I have teammates in who are living in Italy who aren't able to get outside has really helped me to appreciate the fact that I still have that freedom. And so I haven't been, you know, doing structured training, but I've just been doing kind of 3-hour rides where I'm self-sufficient. I've got all the water and snacks that I need. I don't need to stop anywhere. And I've been riding, you know, quite hard, but without the structure and kind of the mental intensity behind that rigidity of training. So yeah, really, I've not really struggled so far. I mean, there of course we all have good days and bad days, but you know, right now, if you have a day off, don't worry about it.
I mean, from social media, Lizzie, dare I say it, looks like you've been having quite a lot of fun.
Yeah, I have actually been having a lot of fun. I've been exploring more trails that I wouldn't usually do, and just taking the time to look at things and love where I am and explore and bake and get in touch with friends that I've not been in touch with for a while. And it's the perfect opportunity to do that. And sometimes I think that you're so focused on training and you're so focused on the goal that you forget to kind of take a step back and look at where you are and appreciate the surroundings. And perhaps somehow this situation has, yeah, brought out the good in some ways that, you know, I've been able to appreciate what I have more than I did before.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, brought to you by iWalker, flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk.
My name's Karen G and I run the Go Ride section of Kendal Cycle Club, which is the junior section. The club is really welcoming to women. It was one of the funny things about myself. I was never thought of myself as a club cyclist. I've cycled all my life and cycling is a major part of my life. And I would have said to you, I am not a club cyclist at all. And I was actually too scared to go on a club ride. And I'd been on the committee as a representative of the junior section for over a year before I actually plucked up courage to go on my first ride, because I just had in my head I wasn't a club cyclist. And the moment I went on one, it was just incredible. Everybody was so welcoming. There's women's only groups. I've made lots of friends. And over the course of the past sort of 3 to 4 years, I've actually done 3 of the away weekends where we've gone away for 3 days. I've done the coast to coast, I've cycled from Edinburgh to Kendal, and I've cycled the north to south route through Wales, which I never thought I would be able to do. And all of those are organised just with women. It's just been incredible.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWalker. Very grateful to them for their support of the Cycling Podcast and the Cycling Podcast Femina. We heard there from Karen G, a member of the Kendal Cycle Club, which iWalker also supports. So very grateful to them for their support and their support of cycling initiatives and their main business, which is supporting businesses, of course. So iWalker, have a look at them at iWalker.com. iwoca.co.uk. I-W-O-C-A. Now, this month's episode is a bit of a special on Annemiek van Vleuten, the best female rider in the world. And I thought I'd just rattle through some of her achievements because, you know, she's been around for a long time, and we tend to think that her performance at the Olympic road race in 2016 was a sort of revelatory performance and divide her career into before and after Rio. Arguably, she would and should have won the gold medal in Rio. She was away and looking pretty good for that win, and when she had a horrible, really sickening crash on the descent, and a lot of people watching that feared the worst. She was back a month later winning again, so it didn't really seem to break her stride an awful lot. But let's go right back to the beginning, because she came to the sport pretty late. I think you're going to mention that, Rose. Her early results tended to be in prologue time trials, actually. She was third in the prologue in 2008 at the Tour Femina en Limousin, behind Ellen van Dijk and Edwig Patel, who we had on the podcast a year or so ago, didn't we, Orla? And she kind of came, although she came to the sport quite late, she kind of hit the ground running. In 2010, I noticed that she raced 69 days, which is quite a lot of racing. And she had three pretty big wins that year. She won a stage at Bira, she won a stage at La Route de France, and she was first overall there. That was a huge win. She also won the Ronde van Drenthe ahead of, big names, Teutenberg, Wild, Vos and Johansson were behind her in that race. 2011, she won the Tour of Flanders, of course, after finishing third at Binda. She also won at Vargarda and Plouay, so that was a successful year for her. 2014, she won the prologue and stage three at the Giro Rosa, and she was eighth overall, probably the first indication that she might have potential in a stage race like that. 2015, she was second at Flèche Wallonne. She won three prologue time trials that year and was second in the other prologue time trials, so really quite dominant in short time trials. 2016, of course, the Olympic Games was the most notable performance, but a month later she won the Lotto Belgium Tour, including the prologue and the final road stage. 2017, she was third at the Giro Rosa behind Anna van der Breggen and Elisa Longo-Borghini. She won La Course by Le Tour de France. In 2018, she won the Giro Rosa, completing that sort of transformation into a stage race rider and a climber. And she was also first at La Course again, a one-day race this time with a really thrilling finish where she caught Anna van der Breggen in the closing couple of metres, really. 2019, she won Strade Bianche. She was second at Flanders, second at Amstel, second in Flèche, first at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, first in the Giro Rosa, and first in the World Road Race Championship. That was her best ever year.
And you left off time trial wins, her World Champion time trial titles as well.
Yeah, I did, actually.
Richard Moore, Mr. Pro Cycling Stats there.
Yeah, I've been spending an enjoyable day browsing Pro Cycling Stats. But I thought it was quite interesting to just go back and look, because as I say, there is this perception that she underwent some kind of transformation around about the time of the Rio Olympics. But it's really been a far more gradual process than that. And we'll hear from her coach a little bit later, which and he, you know, offers some insight into that evolution of Annemiek van Vleuten, the athlete. But we were going to just each of us share a memory or an impression of Annemiek van Vleuten before we go into these interviews. And I suppose mine is from the 2017 La Course, which was a two-day race, a summit finish on the Issoire, and then 2 days later, a time trial in Marseille. She won both. And in Marseille, I went to interview her for the Cycling Podcast Femina and found her quite difficult to interview. She was quite wary, quite guarded, and not all that forthcoming. So, that was my kind of early impression of her, really, I suppose. The following year, 2018, La Course was another impression, just because I suppose the exuberance of the finish, as much as anything. It was a phenomenal race, actually, and a great finish. And sort of, I had her in my mind as a kind of quite serious rider, but there was a real sort of sense of joy I thought that she got out of winning that race, partly maybe because she beat her great rival Anna van der Breggen. She might not like that, but that's maybe part of it. But also just the thrilling nature of it. It was so close. So those two memories from La Course were the strongest for me of Annemiek van Vleuten.
I should actually listen to, I shouldn't say a rival podcast, but I did listen to something from Cycling News where they talked to Annemiek about her top five career moments. It was actually last year that it came out. And she actually said that she felt that La Course in 2018, when she beat Anna van der Breggen by a second, or I mean, it was in the closing 20 metres, wasn't it, that she just overtook Anna van der Breggen. And it was at that moment that she thought that she'd finally got rid of the shackles of being known as the one who crashed at the Rio Olympics. Like, she felt that she had, despite all the other kind of successes she's had between 2016 and 2018, she felt like that was the moment in which she got rid of that title and was, people would then recognise her as being, oh yeah, you won that incredible, thrilling race. That was one of the highlights of the whole cycling calendar. And so that is probably some of that joy came from that kind of moment as well.
But I think that it's interesting because, with time trialists and with riders who win on their own a lot, which she has been, you don't often get that, the sheer joy that comes with, you know, when you see in sprinters, you know, where the win is in doubt until the final few meters, and then you get this explosion of euphoria at the end. And you don't often get that with riders of that type who win, you know, either in a time trial or on their own. But what's interesting, again, going right back to the start, is that she won races in sprints back then. I mean, she still can, but she's so strong now that she can often just win on her own, which is obviously preferable. But, you know, her Tour of Flanders win, for example, way back in 2011 was a small group sprint. So she certainly can do that. And that La Course in 2018, though, really did stand out for me among her more recent wins. What about you two?
Well, I was just going to say, sorry, just talking about that joy, that's the reason I'm so glad we're doing this special on Annemiek van Vleuten and we've had the chance to talk to her, is just speaking to her, it's that sense of joy and love of the sport that I think people might be surprised by a little bit when they hear the interview that's to come, because I've seen that come across on Dutch television, for example, but it's not a sign of Annemiek van Vleuten that we often get in the English-speaking press. And I think that's partly because most of our interviews are done either just before or just after a race. And I think for me, one of the moments that stood out with van Vleuten was after the 2019 Tour of Flanders, when she finished second. And we were in the mix zone at the end. I think, Rose, we were together. And she gave a huge smile and a wave and just said, oh, I listen to the podcast all the time. I love it. And she was so warm and so open. And obviously she was being nice about the podcast, so that endeared me to her anyway. But I just thought, well, that was unnecessary. You didn't have to be so proactively nice. And it was a lovely thing. And it was a flash of that playfulness, I think, that we don't get to see very much. And I've spoken before about interviewing her in Rio. And I also remember an interview I did with her very briefly before Flesh Will On in 2018. And because it was before the race, again, she was quite serious. And that day in Oudenaarde was the first time that I really saw that playfulness from her and that joy. And it's something that comes across an awful lot in the interview to come. She's a very fun-loving person as well as being, you know, incredibly serious athlete, which is wonderful.
And I think that's one of the things that I was going to pick up on that you will hear about in the interviews to come, dear listeners. But it was something that Orla, you touched on about her love of riding her bike and her love of racing. And it surprised me hearing about how she only kind of entered the professional ranks at the age of 25. And we're kind of used to hearing about these riders that are climbing through juniors and then they go into the professional ranks straight from there. And so they're younger than the age that most male riders join the professional ranks. So for her to become a pro, I mean, I remember at Rabobank, and, you know, then she was there for a few years, but she only started at 25 is remarkable. And I had a little look at what Marianne Vos had got up to by the age of 25. And obviously Marianne Vos is a very special case of someone who has won everything from a very young age. But by the same age that Annemieke was just starting, Marianna had won 2 world championships, 4 Flèche Wallonne, 3 Binders, 13 stages of Giro Rosa, 2 overalls at the Giro Rosa, and an Olympics gold. So that's what Marianna was up to.
Wow.
Up to 25. So to think that Annemieke had started at that point, it kind of shows you that, you know, she's probably still is fresh and she probably still is motivated, and there's still, you know, plenty of work to do. I mean, if you win an Olympic gold at the age of 25, I mean, what is left? Well, obviously, Marianna just wins everything again and again and again. But it just shows you a bit about kind of where that kind of motivation and that love of the sport has come from.
Well, let's hear our interview, shall we? We're going to hear from Annemieke van Vleuten, from her coach, who's been her coach for a long time, Louis Delahaye. Also from her Michelin Scott teammate, Lucy Kennedy. And Lizzie Banks again, who obviously is a rival on another team. When did you begin working with Annemieke van Vleuten?
It was 2012, I think, when Rabobank got a women's team.
Was she a rider that you identified then as having the potential that we've all seen now? Or, you know, what were her characteristics back then that you spotted?
Oh, she was already a good rider. I think she already won Tour of Flanders. At that point in time, I was more or less responsible for, all the team Rabobank teams we had on let's say a training technical level. There was a development team, we had a cyclocross team, we had our professional team, and now there was a new women's team, and I introduced myself there, and Annemieke wanted to talk to me, and out of this conversation came that we were starting to work together. So it was her question, more or less. Already then she was one of the better riders. Slightly different riders. She was more like a classic specialist.
I mean, we tend to divide her career almost in two, before and after the Rio Olympics in 2016. She seemed to come back from that crash and that disappointment with a sort of new focus, a new determination. Do you agree with that, or to your eyes, has she always been the same athlete?
I think it already started earlier. I think it already started like in 2000, let's say 14.
Well,
she was always classified as a classic rider, and she agreed with it, and she won classics in the beginning of her career already. Like I said with Flanders, but she was curious. Can I be also a rider who can climb, and a rider who can win stage races? And I said, why not? But we have to change a few things. So from that point in time, from 2014, we changed the training more or less. And Rio was the first, let's say, big goal, of course. And there she showed that for herself that she could be the best in the world. And maybe before she didn't expect it, but there she thought, hey, I can climb, I can do it in a one-day race, so it's also possible to do it in a stage race. So it was, yes, Rio was very important, but the process of changing as a rider already started 2 years before.
You completed your degree, you seem to have enjoyed student life, and you qualified, am I right, with a master's in epidemiology?
Yeah, so I finished my study about avian influenza, and at that time they were a bit scared that the avian influenza, the zeevogelgriep, would like transform. And maybe people also got sick of it, and then we would not have a vaccine for it. So at that time, they were already scared of that one. So that was my subject of my thesis. And I also did it with the RAVM, that's like the institute that's now really hot topic and really... I'm an epidemiologist, but like it's 12 years ago. So I followed the news with a bit more interest. But for the rest, I'm not very into it anymore. And I don't think also I don't want to do something with it in the future. But I had a really good student time.
So, yeah, I mean, by your own admission, you enjoyed student life. You enjoyed the fun, the youth, the partying, I guess, that came with it. So when did you decide that bike racing was for you and that you weren't going to continue along the epidemiology route?
Yeah, so I was, before I was always playing soccer, and I really liked soccer, and the main thing, and I still miss it sometimes, is the team feeling, yeah, with soccer. So I had a really great team, and I really loved the fun in the dressing room, yeah, just to play out there, like on the field with 11 girls. I really loved that, but I had to say goodbye to the soccer because I got injured on my knee. And then actually, yeah, I never thought about riding a bike myself because I really loved the sport already, but I never thought that I could ride, like, be a cyclist. I never thought about that option, but actually the doctor told me that I had to ride a bike. And in combination with being a little bit overweight from all the student beers and kilos I gained, I'm like, I need a little bit of balance and I need to stay fit and do a little bit of sport. So that was actually what I got me into cycling. But at first I was really like, I didn't know. My family was always on the bike, but I didn't like it.
I didn't realise that. So what age were you then when you started properly racing, when you, I guess, had your first race licence?
Yeah, I bought my first second-hand bike in 2005. And in 2007 I had my first year with some races in the Netherlands. And then in 2008 I joined the UCI team.
So 2007, you started racing, that what, you were 25, is that right?
2007, I was, 24.
I mean, that would be considered quite late these days, wouldn't it, in professional cycling? Do you think that's maybe part of the reason that you're still so successful? You're relatively fresh, I guess, because you started racing quite late compared to maybe someone now who might start at 15, 17, something like that?
Oh yeah, I'm sure that this is the secret why I'm still so motivated, and I'm also very, how to say it, intrinsic motivation. So I never did it because my parents wanted me to ride a bike. It's just like something I just have the motivation to get the best out of myself, and it's also the reason I think why I still improve, because I started so late, so that gives me the opportunity to still improve, and that's why I'm speaking a little bit later, and that keeps me still very hungry to continue, because my coach, haven't found the top yet, I think, because I improve still every year, and every year we think like, this is the top. Yeah, we discover some new points to work on and some new things to improve, and yeah. It's one of the reasons is because I started so late that my peak is a little bit later.
I want to ask you about Louis in a little bit. We spoke to him about you for the podcast and he said some wonderful things. But I want to take you back to Tour of Flanders in 2011, because considering that you only had your first joined your first UCI Pro team in 2008, to then win Flanders in 2011, I was watching back the Sporza interview with you after the race win, and the interviewer said, oh, you know, did you dare believe last night that you would be the Tour of Flanders winner today? And you just said, yep.
And he didn't expect an answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Where did that confidence come from? How did you know? I mean, 3 years of racing is quite long enough, I guess. But, I mean, that was a big race win. That was, I guess, your marker on the international scene, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I surprised myself already a little bit before. Except for in Corsair, didn't I? I remember that I became first. And that was already a really breakthrough thing for me, because I was never a really good climber. And then I could suddenly keep up with Emma Cooley, which was a really good climber. So I surprised myself there already. But yeah, for sure the people from the Belgian television didn't follow the results of Corsair Binda. But for me, that was a really breakthrough moment that I could follow Emma Cooley down those climbs. So I was thinking that, I'm in a way better shape than I was ever before. So I was like, yeah, and maybe I can also make it now over the muur. And that was the first year I made it over the muur of Gerardsbergen.
And you were very much seen as a classics rider in the early part of your career. How would you describe yourself now? Would you call yourself a climber, an all-rounder? How would you classify yourself?
Oh, yeah. Now, I always say, like, I'm not a time trialer. And when I was still wearing the rainbow stripes for the last 2 years, I still consider myself not as a time trialer. And then, like, these days, for my team, was really laughing, like, hey, but you're the world champion. It's like, yeah, no, but I'm not a real time trialer. Because a real time trialer, I see as that are the person that are super focused, super control freaks, and only looking at numbers and... I don't know. I'm more the girl that likes to play. So I prefer more road racing than time trialing. I hate time trialing, actually, to be honest. It's not my favorite thing. And I don't mind the training for the time trial. So that's not a thing. But yeah, the suffering and like also like I'm not really a control freak. So I'm not looking all the time to my numbers. I like more to train out, to go with my feeling. Actually, Louis also teach me that, to go more with feeling. So yeah, I think I'm more, a bit more a rounder, and also I think I'm more a one-day racer than a straight racer. So I like to target the Giro Rosa, but I like more to just race one-day races, because then I can just race with my heart.
I mean, one of the things that we observe about Annemiek is the huge volume that she does. I mean, has that always been part of her training and something that she's been
No. Let's say the discussion after the first year or first or second year we worked together was that my idea was, okay, we have to do more volume. And for her, and I mean, I say it in her own words, is she needed more speed. So she needed more like 30-second, 1 minute reps to become a better athlete. So we disagreed on that. We had a discussion and I said, okay, I mean, this is my idea, this is your idea, but yeah. And she said, okay, I want to try this. And then that's the point in time where we changed her training completely to, let's say, a higher volume. And yes, she has she does a high volume, but it's not like super, super high. I mean, I work with a lot of really good riders in the men's category. Annemiek doesn't do as much as these guys. So, and for me, there is not a reason why a woman more or less cannot train what a man can train in volume-wise. And the second thing I have to add is that we build it up. We started in 2014 and we gradually grow to the volume that she does now. And I think that she makes the difference there. And I think the philosophy, at least the training philosophy in women's cycling was, okay, Liège-Bastogne-Liège for guys is like 250. For women, it's like 120. So our volume doesn't have to be that high. I think that is that's wrong thinking, in my opinion, because why are men not training more than they can do? Because they reach more or less the limit from what you can do in 1 year. I mean, there is a lot of research on that, what you can do more or less, and it's like, let's say, 25 hours on average a week till 30 for a whole year. That's about the limit. But they don't do more because it doesn't bring more, and it is the limit. But, you know, as a woman, you can get to that limit as well. Because if you look at a 1,500-meter swimmer, is discipline is less than 15 minutes. And they also make more or less this volume in triathlon. They make more or less this volume because probably there is a limit there somewhere. So why, for me, there is not a big difference between a 120-kilometer race and a 250-kilometer race. It's both extreme endurance exercise. And so that's more or less the philosophy I use to coach people. Okay, 25 to 30 hours is a lot in a week, but we will get there in 5-6 years. And that's what Annemiek did, more or less.
Yeah, she built very gradually to that. I mean, she's in her late 30s now, but still seems to be improving the last couple of years anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, every at the end of the year, we always have a nice dinner and we discuss what we did the year before and the results and how what are we going to do next year. And like 3 or 4 years ago, every year I said, well, Annemiek, let's be fair. You're not going to be better than this. It was a fantastic year. You had your first world title in time trial, but yeah, this is the limit. I don't say that anymore. Yeah, we were every year we were able to do something extra or to do something different, which probably gave her a new stimulus. And I think her best level is now.
Do you know what's really funny, Annemiek? From the outside to an international audience, I think most people would see you as being super serious. And I was saying this to the guys in the podcast and on the podcast, I think, that from Dutch TV, I can see that playfulness and I can see how much you enjoy it. But I'm not sure that people beyond the Netherlands necessarily realise that about you. I mean, you seem to have a lot of fun on the bike. Is that important to you still?
Yeah, that's also the reason, I think, because of why I still love riding my bike at my age. Because I think I'm pretty good in finding ways to still enjoy it. So I know, like, in the winter, I don't like to train. So that's why I go to new countries. It gives me energy to go to Colombia. But I'm not the kind of girl that is, like, always continuing and not stopping. I think if you watch the documentary that they made, the Dutch television, about me, how I was training in Colombia, a lot of people are like, oh, actually, you really enjoy it. Like, yeah, you're not stressed. No, I'm not stressed. For me, it's really important to enjoy riding my bike, and maybe sometimes I compromise a little bit my training to stop, for example, for a lunch stop, and I stop there for 1 hour, and yes, maybe then I don't have, like, the 100% benefit of the training ride because I break it up in two parts. But if that a way to keep me mentally healthy and happy, then that's the key for me to still enjoy it and still continue. And so I'm not a machine, I think. A lot of people think that I'm a machine, that I'm like doing, that I'm a perfect athlete and doing a lot of extreme things. Yes, I do maybe the training, but I just always in a way that I enjoy and I don't do the things I don't enjoy. For example, I don't want to put myself in an altitude tent because I think it doesn't make me happy. I want to sleep well and I don't look forward to that. And that could be maybe a good thing, but I don't want to do that. Like to go to Colombia, yes, I train really hard there, but I also really enjoyed everything. And because I take good company with me and have some fun on the rides and have some good conversations. I meet nice people, and to do those long rides in the Netherlands, that would kill me. But yeah, to go to Colombia and meet new people, then it gives me energy. So, but then sometimes maybe, yeah, you compromise a little bit to join some other athletes. And maybe you don't do your training vice versa. Maybe it's better to do them on a trainer inside all my efforts. But I compromise a little bit because I like to go outside and I'm not a machine that wants to train all the time on the trainer. I want to enjoy my rides. And then I compromise a little bit. But in the end, I think this works for me.
I always think that this is one of the things that you can't measure when it comes to success with athletes, that happiness is a big, big factor. And if you're enjoying it, you can't measure that. But it seems to feed into the momentum, the motivation, the drive so much.
Yeah, I always feel like I have like 100 points to spend my energy. And I want to spend them like in a way that on the points, I think that makes me really faster. So I don't want to spend too much in too much all kind of details that maybe can help me, but also make me mentally really tired to focus on 100 things. So I try to put my energy in some stuff that really makes me faster. And I also accept, on the other hand, that I'm not maybe the perfect athlete. For example, I go a lot of times way too late to bed because I'm just a night owl. And I always thought, like, to be world champion, you need to be, like, perfect athlete. I can say I'm not a perfect athlete, and I accepted it. But it makes me more happy just to have a little bit more relaxed schedule, and I'm not a really strict person. It just doesn't suit me, so I just accepted myself, and it works for me.
Shoot. Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet interrupting this month's episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina to remind me to tell you that it is sponsored by Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix is an online personal styling service for men and women, where an expert stylist picks clothes just for you based on your taste, size, and price preferences, and sends them straight to your door. It's perfect if you want to discover something new or if you don't like clothes shopping. Well, traditional clothes shopping isn't actually an option for any of us at the moment, but Stitch Fix are here to help you treat yourself without needing to leave the house. Stitch Fix personal stylists, who all work safely from home, of course, are ready to select you 5 surprise items to hopefully put a smile on your face. How does it work? Well, it's easy and actually really fun. You go to Stitch Fix's website and complete a style profile about your clothing preferences, shapes, sizes, and what you like to wear. Then it's over to your stylist, who'll hand select and send to you 5 items of clothing and accessories, which you discover when they arrive at your front door, along with a nice card including outfit inspiration and style tips. Try everything on, keep and pay for what you like, and send back the rest. Delivery and returns are free and includes an option-free home courier pickup, which is particularly useful at the moment. Stitch Fix have also extended their try-on window from 1 week to 6 weeks, so you've got extra time to send anything back, which again is very handy at the moment. And the best bit, you pay just £10 for your stylist time, which is redeemable against anything that you keep. If you fancy giving yourself a treat, then go and get started with Stitch Fix. Go to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. Right now. That's stitchfix.co.uk/cycling.
I first met Annemiek at the end of 2016, when she was in Australia following the sort of the whole Rio season, and she was just in Australia on her off season doing a bit of pre-season training and just a bit of holidaying, and she actually did this little tour in the Alpine region of Victoria called the Tour of Bright, which is a great little tour, and she was just, you know, riding around, fluffing around. So I met her there, and from then it was like she was instantly this sort of mentor. I actually won that tour, and she was just, you know, amazingly supportive and friendly, and from then on I kind of really looked up to her. To think then that I would actually be a teammate of her in only a couple of years' time was just, I wouldn't have believed that if you told me that. But that's actually where our relationship started, and I've looked up to her ever since then. So to then be riding with her and for her a couple of years later was pretty unreal.
Wow, that's amazing. And did she give you any advice about how to approach joining the professional ranks at that time, or how to be a better climber? Or
yeah, so she actually had like quite a big impact on the beginning of my career, really. She actually went out of her way to be helpful. I am quite a shy person, so I didn't reach out to her. She actually came to me as to help me in my career, and she personally spoke to a couple of teams in Europe and was really trying hard to get me over there. And I won that tour, and so from that moment she planted the first seeds in what was then Mitchelton. It was then Orica Scott, and now Mitchelton Scott. She actually planted the seeds then. I was like, oh, you got to, you know, keep an eye out for this Australian girl. She played a really, really important part in my progression from domestic racing to international. Yeah,
that's amazing. I think people often get kind of an impression, well, from doing kind of press interviews with Annemiek, that she's kind of a no-nonsense, very direct person. But clearly she's, you know, behind that, she's a much, you know, more kind of generous person. Would you say that's the case?
Oh, yeah. She's incredibly generous with her time and her knowledge and with anyone. You know, I was just this, you know, unknown Australian cyclist, and she approached me and chatted to me and wanted to know my story and what my goals were, and offered lots of advice. But I've seen it, you see it, you know, we'll be out for a,
before a race, we'll be out doing a recon or just out for a training ride as a team. And she, you know, will often be waiting for her because she sees someone that she knows from, you know, like her neighbor's best friend's aunts. You know, she just wants to talk to everyone. She's really, really generous with her time and wants to know everyone's story and just the whole, she just really loves the cycling community.
And how does that work when, you know, you've been with her for both of her Giro Rosa wins? Does she take on that kind of leadership role as well as being kind of one of the star riders?
Yeah, I mean, I think when, you know, when it's a race that she's particularly focused on, that like that's the target of her season, she does, her focus is, it's something else.
Yeah.
So it's probably like, they're probably a slight exception where she really goes into full race mode and she's not so much into the joking around. And but in those scenarios, she's just the sort of epitome of professionalism. And it's quite remarkable just how focused she can be and every little thing is done to perfection. You see the different phases of her throughout the season and different races, and she's got this ability to, I don't think anyone could maintain that level of focus all the year. And it wouldn't be the same, you know, if you were, you need to have that sort of flow of different levels of focus, and she does that really well.
When we see her training on Instagram and things like that, it's so precise and it's so detail, it's so much as well. Do you think that's something that she's kind of pioneered? Is that something that you as a teammate and maybe the other riders in the peloton kind of look up to and or try and emulate in some way?
I don't think we try and emulate it. I mean, as in the quantity. The focus, yes. I think she's really unique though in the way that she can train. She's obviously, yeah, she has pioneered that way of training for herself, and it obviously works for her, and she can handle it and thrives on it. But I don't think there are too many women, there are no other women training the way that she does now, and I'm not sure that there are. I don't think I could. I'm quite sure I couldn't handle the kind of volume that she does. She's found this way over a number of years that works for her incredibly well. And it's, yeah, I wouldn't say I try to emulate it, but I've got a lot of respect for it. And, yeah, it does make you think about, the different ways of training and finding that way that works best for you.
I met Annemiek for the first time when I won stage 8 of the Giro Rosa last year, and she was the GC leader, and we met in the anti-doping trailer behind the podium. Not very glamorous at all. Of course, Annemiek is a formidable competitor. There is a reason that she's the world champion. She's an incredibly talented bike rider, but it's much more than talent. She trains incredibly hard. You know, I'd go as far as to say that she probably trains harder than anybody else in the women's peloton. And I think that's quite interesting because, you know, there are lots of fantastic cyclists, and the way Annemiek trains is very well known for being, you know, a lot more hours than a lot of people train. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right thing to do for everybody. You know, Lizzie Deignan is also very well known for saying that she barely ever does a 5-hour ride over winter, and that actually long rides just make her tired. So I think it's a really important balance that young riders especially know that a lot of hours isn't the only way to get fit. So for me personally, I like a balance of shorter training and longer training. I know that for me, overtraining and kind of a really high load of training, the kind of thing Annemiek does, but not quite as much, I know that that's actually hugely beneficial for me. But I have to balance that with adequate rest. And if I don't take enough rest, then I just screw myself. So I also get a big benefit from kind of short, sharp training. So it's really a balance. And what I'm saying is that, you know, there's not there's not one size fits all for training. And although that works for Annemieke, she's had many, many years of conditioning to allow her and enable her to train that much. And so do what's right for you and not what's right for somebody else.
It's interesting that you say that that kind of reputation precedes her, and I suppose we've become more aware of it, and there's, you know, we've seen the kind of the films released by the team about her training with the men's team and so on, but it's become part of the Annemieke van Vleuten mystique, or the brand, if you like. Is that a weapon that she has? I mean, the fact that it's so known that she trains so hard, and that, you know, on the start line, she's got that, if nothing else, the fact that, you know, her competitors know that she's trained extremely hard.
Absolutely. And I think the mental side of it is so huge, and it's so underrated. And the thing is, if you come to the start line and you see Annemieke in the rainbow bands and you think there's no way I can beat her, then already you're racing for second place. You have to come with an attitude that everybody is beatable. And it's true, because everybody has their weakness. Like I said, Annemieke is a fantastic athlete, and she's clearly one of the best in the world. But she will have bad days. She will have misfortune. Or maybe you'll have a super day. You need to go in there with the attitude that you can be the best, that you can come in first place. And if you don't have that attitude, then you don't have a chance of winning.
Annemieke, I mean, speaking to some of the other women in the peloton, they talk about, you know, how she's really raised the bar in terms of not just performance, but how she lives, how she trains, how she, you know, takes herself off to altitude and lives in a way that has really taken women's cycling to a new level. I mean, is that something that is just part of her makeup? Have you seen that side of her develop over the years?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, she does what she likes to do. She enjoys, well, almost every day. It is not like she is suffering a lot because, yeah, she has to train 25 hours or 30 hours a week. She's not suffering a lot because she has to stay by herself on a mountain for altitude training. This is what she likes to do. She was in Colombia 2 times. She came back after the first time. She was 1 month there in it was December, and she said, yeah, I had holiday, I come back, I did an awful lot of training, but I had the idea it feels like holiday. Well, okay, then it's not like somebody has to suffer a lot, huh?
Mm.
So she likes cycling, she likes traveling, so she's doing what she likes, and I try to find out on an individual basis what every different rider likes. If you don't like to be on a mountain by yourself, then don't go on altitude, because maybe it works physiologically, but for sure psychologically it's a big mistake to make, because you come back, your body says yes, but your mind says no. In the end, no result.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think we're discovering in this lockdown period as well how different people cope differently in, you know, situations like this. And some people are maybe more comfortable with their own company, which is fortunate in her case. I mean, another aspect of her training that we've seen is training she does with the male riders. How did that
come about?
Yeah, but
that's 10 days in a year.
Mm, yeah, it's a short, yeah.
And yeah, that is very extreme. And I wouldn't recommend it to everybody. But one of the things Annemieke likes is to get... She is very comfortable with getting out of her comfort zone. Let's put it like that. As she is looking for, hey, what can we do to get myself out of the comfort zone? Yeah, the 10 days with the guys, that's out of her comfort zone. She's a little bit scared for that. I think that's why it brings something.
But I know
because of the last year what she did, that she can deal with it.
I guess
that it doesn't kill her.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I guess you as a coach, though, you say it's just 10 days, but those are days that you have, I guess, less control over in terms of the effort she's making. We can see that. You know, for her, it's just about hanging on and really, as you say, taking yourself outside her comfort zone. But how do you manage that training when
I don't have control over her when she's in the Giro Italia? I mean, that's the same. Or I don't have control over a rider when he is in the Tour de France. It's 3 weeks. Other people have control. You don't even control it yourself. I mean, with the training camp with the guys of Mitchelton, she has more or less control, because after 3 days, when she is really, really, really tired, she can say, okay, tomorrow I'm not going to ride. We always had that option, especially last year, because she was coming back from her knee injury. And we said, okay, we're going to try 2 days, and maybe the third day you take rest. But in the end, she did everything. But we looked at it at a daily basis. Hey, how do you feel? You think you can do tomorrow? Mm. And think towards the end of this camp. So, yeah, there is no control. But I think in this case, for these 10 days, it's okay to don't have control.
I mean, she's maybe unusual, Annemiek, in some respects. I mentioned other riders looking at her and realizing that she is setting the benchmark for women's cycling. Yeah. But I guess not every female rider could do what she's doing, and it would be a mistake for some of them to take on that.
Of course. No, I mean, the fact that Annemiek is doing now, and again, I say it, I coached a lot of guys who did a lot more than Annemiek did at her max, so it's not that exceptional, in my opinion. I mean, I work with triathletes in the moment. Guys and girls do the same amount of volume of training, and why not? They race the same, there they also race the same distance. But so it's not that exceptional, but I think it depends a little bit on what type you are. Are you more the endurance type, or more like Marianne, a little bit more explosive type? I mean, Marianne can also win the bunch sprint against good sprinters. That is a different type, so they are normally not responding that well on super high volume. But when you are more on the endurance side of the spectrum, like Annemiek is, you respond to better to a high volume. And then again, we started in 2014, it's now 2020. In 2014, she was not doing what she does now. So I do not recommend it to everybody, but if you're the endurance type, I would, as a coach, I would invest with my rider in raising the bar, also volume-wise, but step by step. You're not going from 15 hours a week to 25 hours a week in 1 year.
Mm.
And that's also what we didn't do. We also did it step by step, and that's, for me, is the reason that she improved gradually every year. She became better and better.
A lot is made of the Annemiek pre-2016 and that horrific crash at the Olympic Games and the Annemiek van Vleuten afterwards. Now, your trainer, Louis, who you've mentioned, said that that transformation in terms of results and what kind of rider you were, or rather, actually started quite a bit earlier in 2014 when you changed your training. So talk us through that.
The start and my transformation as a different rider started with when we went to Brazil, to Rio, to see the course in the Olympic Games. And it was in November 2016, I remember it very well. And I saw the course there and I thought like, oh, if I want to be selected for the Olympic Games next year, I need to improve my climbing abilities, otherwise I will not even be selected. And at that time I was not thinking about winning the Olympic Games, I was just not thinking like, be really the best domestique I want to be for the team. And then I made a plan and got the right people around me to improve my climbing abilities. And for sure, also Louis was also involved with this, and also my nutritionist, and also like a plan we made together to climb more. I think that was the key secret. And then I found in 2016 that I went more to altitude, and that result was also already in that I discovered for the first time that I could, for example, attack on the cowberg instead of being dropped on the cowberg. Mm-hmm. So that was a really eye-opener, like, hey, I can now use a climb to make a difference.
And I guess in that context then, how you were climbing and how you were going at the Olympic Games was a sign that you could do it, that it was working. Because for me and for a lot of people watching, I think, you probably won't remember, but I came to interview you at Holland House just after you got out of hospital. And I remember thinking, everyone was thinking how unlucky you were to have crashed, but how lucky you were, I guess, to have emerged from it in one piece. And I guess I was expecting to find you a bit reflective of that. Instead, what I got from you was just how encouraged you were by how well you were climbing, but also how disappointed you were, devastated that you couldn't then deliver on that. And it was just a completely different perspective, I think, to what I expected to find from you. But I guess in that sense, Rhea was a sign for you that you could climb.
Yeah, so it really inspired me that I took the inspiration from it. And for sure, I've also got the outside world had really the impact of seeing the video footage. And when I watched the video footage, I could understand why everyone was like really happy that I was still in one piece, and that I should also be really happy that I'm still alive and that I didn't have any consequences of this horror crash. But yeah, for myself, I was, what I don't take home message from the Rio Olympic Games was the eye-opener, like, hey, I can do more on, I can use climbs as an opportunity to win races. And if I focus on something to get myself to a better climber, I'm able to transform myself in a climber. So it inspires me, like, if I focus on something, I can show beautiful things. And maybe it didn't work out in the Rio Olympic Games, but then it will work out in the future. And I saw, like, it inspired me to set some new goals.
So in that sense, was what happened in Rio, has it been fuel for you? Has it been a motivator for you in a way that maybe winning an Olympic gold might not have been? Or is that too simplistic, do you think?
No, I don't think that that would have been different, winning the gold medal or not. It would have inspired me in both ways. If I would have won the medal, it would have inspired me also, and I would have been also eye-opener, like, hey, I'm good in this. But then I would have had the reward already. So, no, I don't think it would have made a difference. It was just the whole year was maybe an eye-opener for me that, that I got myself into better climbing, and that there were better, more races for me to target on, and I could target different races.
When Richard spoke to Louis, your trainer, he told him that you both sit down at the end of the year, you have a dinner, you sort of review what has happened last year and you look ahead to next year. And he said that he used to say to you, Annemiek, I don't think you're going to get better than this year. 2017, for example, you become world time trial champion, you've won La Course, sorry, this is as good as it gets. And then, of course, you do the same next year and then you win the Giro Rosa as well. He says he stopped telling you that you're not going to get any better and that he believes you are as good as you've ever been. How good can you be, Annemiek? What more is there for you?
Yeah, and every year, like, together with Louis, we stopped to say this to each other, because I think we started in 2016. We stopped telling each other, and I think, it must end somewhere, because I get older and older. And one of the parts is that I started really late, so that my peak, that I improved also a little bit on my older age, is because I started a bit later. I surprised myself this year again, because I was confident that I got myself into a better shape than ever before in the spring classics. And usually I had always struggles to be good in the spring, but I was really confident that I was really good in spring. So yeah, still I see small details to improve on, and I still see them also now in this period with the coronavirus. I still see the opportunities to get better and details to work on, or a tool that can help me to work on, or some material that gets me faster, or so it's still a journey to get the best out of myself. And as long as I'm on this journey to get the best out of myself, that's like my number one motivation. So the races are not motivating me, but it's really this journey together with Louis and the people around me that help me, my support network, to get the best out of myself.
just as a coach, I wondered what you thought as you watched the World Championship road race in Yorkshire, and you saw her hit out so early. What were your thoughts?
I thought, okay, she's going for the plan. I mean, she was on an altitude camp in Livigno, and well, we were talking on the phone, and it was about the world champs and the course, and they said, okay, there is only one really steep climb, but it's really early. She said, why you wouldn't try it? Well, and that's where the plan started, and it became more like a living.
Was it really, to go on her own or to take a small group?
No, we didn't expect her to be so strong that she went on her own. She thought it would probably be a group of, let's say, maximum three or four riders. Mm. Said, okay, then almost everybody has a medal, so everybody is willing to ride. Then it really has a chance. And now she was on her own, and, well, she looked comfortable, and you know, the worst thing that could have happened is that they would have caught her. But you saw the group behind her was working as well. So they were not, even if they would have caught her, they wouldn't be fresh. Huh? So, yeah, what I was mainly enjoying it. I thought when she gets away with this, it's super. And when she doesn't get away with this, well, she at least tried. It was a nice day.
Do you feel like you need that Olympic gold then to, I guess, complete? I don't mean complete your career, as in that would be the end of your career, your retirement. But do you feel like you need to, when you look back on your career, when it's all done, do you need that gold medal, do you think, to feel like, yep, I've done it all? Or is it about becoming as good as you can be and seeing where that takes you?
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing that I want. My goal for the Olympics is that I want to be at my best level next year in August in the Tumtown in the road race. And if I have done everything about that, like within the limit, so not being the perfect athlete, but being the almost perfect athlete that's still happy to get there, then I'm going to be satisfied because I don't have in control what the other ones will be doing. But I will just be at my best level there, and yeah, for sure the Olympic medal is something that lacks in my in the prizes I have won. So it would be the icing on the cake for sure, and it's a really big goal. The most important thing is that I want to get myself there at my highest level possible, and hopefully better than I was already this year.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast Femina. You can get 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. And I have been, I mentioned this on the other podcast, I've been enjoying the new Go Energy Bakes, which are basically cakes that you can take with you on your bike. They are, if bars can be a little bit too hard, a bit too difficult to chew, these are just crumbly, melt-in-your-mouth cakes in various flavours.
What's the take on eating them just as snacks? That's allowed, isn't it?
I have been doing a little bit. I've been doing a little bit of that.
Well, it's giving you energy, isn't it? Anything that takes any kind of exertion, you gotta fuel up for it. So childcare, getting out of bed, any of it.
It is food.
I've got
them over there beside my bike set up in here in my office here. It's beside my inside my turbo trainer. I've been snacking on those quite regularly, so that's been good. So check them out at scienceandsport.com, the Go Energy Bakes range. So it was good to hear, wasn't it, at length from Annemiek van Vleuten, from her coach, and from a couple of other riders, Lucy Kennedy and Lizzie Banks there. I mean, what were your takeaways from... I thought it was interesting what Louis Delahaye and Annemiek said about what came through was just how much she enjoys. She's in that kind of sweet spot, it seems to me, of really having found something that she loves to do and realizing that the more she does it, the better she is at it. She's quite, I don't want to say unusual, but she's somebody, and it's not the case for everybody, but clearly she's got a physiology that means that she can handle a lot of volume and that it has a beneficial effect on her. And fortunately enough, she does seem to enjoy that too. So, yeah, her enjoyment of what she does, I guess, was the thing that came through the loudest. That is apart from the beeping noise that was her oven. That, that came through quite loudly as well. Anyway, what did you think? Yeah.
My standouts were, firstly, that both her and Louis think that there is even better to come. I absolutely love that, because we keep thinking, surely she's done everything she can. And we tend to think of her as being a little bit monastic, I think, that she lives this kind of perfectly limited athlete's life where everything is based around performance and training. And clearly that's not the case. She, you know, enjoyment is a big part of it. But the fact that both her and Louis think that not only is she in the best shape of her life, but that there is more to come from it all, really sends shivers down my spine. I find that incredibly exciting. And also, the other thing for me was that you alluded to it there, Richard. Maybe it's just me, I don't know if I've ever said it out loud, but I've often thought, right, okay, well, Annemiek has clearly taken training and professionalism to what we consider to be a new level, right? The simplistic question to come from that is, well, why isn't everybody else doing the same then? Like, why isn't everybody else following that training regime? Because it clearly works. But for Louis to say, you know, he said, well, the volume he doesn't think is actually that extortionate, but that he wouldn't recommend it for everyone. That kind of training isn't for everyone. That was quite a standout for me as well, because obviously everyone is completely different and every athlete is completely different, but other athletes wouldn't get the same results necessarily from that same volume or from whatever combination of things that she does. And as you say, Richard, she enjoys all of this, going to Colombia and whatnot. So yeah, the altitude is a wonderful thing, but the fact that she's able to have fun and people are wanting to take selfies with her and everybody knows who she is, and that fuels her, I think, and motivates her in different ways. So, yeah, for me, that was the other standout, that it's not a blueprint for everybody else. It works for her and it works phenomenally well for her, but there are reasons that others aren't necessarily copying.
I was just inspired by the idea that you could be a kind of unhealthy, lazy, night owl, overweight student and you can say that you hate time trialing and still win two world championship time trials. So that just gives me hope that I could be successful in absolutely anything, even if I hated it.
Are you going to do anything about that inspiration?
No, because that's the difference between me and Annemiek, is that I could not be bothered. Still couldn't be bothered, even if I could be the best of it. I don't think I could. But there you go. That's why I'm not a pro athlete. But the other thing I loved also was the anecdote from Lucy Kennedy. And I was not expecting to... I had not heard this anecdote before about the fact that Annemiek was so instrumental in getting Lucy Kennedy a pro contract and getting her that spot at Middleton Scott. I just thought that was so kind of generous. And I think you often get used to kind of these world-class athletes, these athletes that stand head and shoulders above everyone else. You normally hear about them being divas or being demanding or kind of wanting to have a little clique and, you know, not open the doors to everyone else. But when I spoke to Lucy a bit after the interview, a bit more about the fact that Annemiek had got her involved, Lucy just said that she's so passionate for women's cycling, about spreading the message of women's cycling, getting more people involved in it, more people watching and more women on their bikes, that is the thing that motivates her. That was the thing that motivated her to get Lucy on board, bring her over to Europe, and that's the thing that motivates her every day.
Yeah, that line about hating time trialing stood out for me as well, because, as I mentioned there, particularly early in her career, that seemed to be her speciality. She also said she's more of a a one-day racer than a stage racer, which she's won both, hasn't she? But you get the impression, again, over the last couple of years that her focus has been on stage racing, and that the Giro Rosa seems to have been her biggest goal. And you know, she's become a very strong climber. I mean, she's a strong all-rounder. She reminds me a little bit of Chris Hoy in a way, where the improvement has come over a long period of time, and it's been incremental but pretty consistent, and there's been a little bit of building every year. And Louis talked about that as well, the fact that they've been working together for a long time, and that what we're seeing now are the fruits of a long-term plan. And also the sort of volume that she does now is, you know, that's been built up to over many years. It's not, I mean, because training is funny, because it does follow fashion, or, you know, there are fashions in training, whether it be altitude, you know, high quality, quantity, and so on. And often whoever's winning at a particular time, you know, becomes very influential, because it's thought that they have the recipe, the blueprint for success. So when Team Sky began to train in a certain way, everybody else started doing that too. And I get the impression now that, you know, people are looking at Annemiek van Vleuten and thinking it's all about volume, and, you know, really taking yourself outside your comfort zone, training with the men's team as she does, and so on. But as you say, and as Lizzie Banks said, that doesn't work. That's not going to work for everybody. And it's certainly not going to work from one season to the next, you know, going from an emphasis on high quality training to volume, because I think, you know, that's something where you have to build up to. That's something you have to build up to over a long period of time.
As is finding something that works, whatever that might be. And she has just found over a long period of time what works for her, and just seems to be enjoying that ever more. Rose, you said, you know, if you keep putting all of that effort in and you win, then of course you can get even more enjoyment out of it. And that doesn't look to be stopping anytime soon. And you would think that. You know, she said to me that not getting Olympic gold in 2016 wasn't a fuel for her in any way. The Olympics obviously will be a target for her. I would imagine not getting to show off those rainbow bands will also add fuel to that fire. But for me, just listening to her and listening to Louis, any doubt I might have had as to whether she would be able to keep that form or build in that form for a possible Olympics next year has gone out of the window, really, because I feel like if she stays on the same trajectory, you've got to bet on her regardless, you know. People talk about her age. Yes, she'll be a year older, but as we've discovered, she's as fresh as a daisy. But it was just a joy, actually, to talk to her, a real joy. And my other takeaway was, genuinely, Boer Zoekt Vrouw. It's wonderful. If anybody listening speaks Dutch, you want to learn Dutch, check it out. It's beautiful. I love it. So thank you, Annemiek, for that recommendation. That's going to keep me going through the rest of quarantine.
Yeah, I mean, she's 37. She'll be 38 in October. You know, she'll be coming up to 39 when the Olympic Games are on next year. But I'm not sure that is so much of an issue. She's not going to, I don't think she's going to, her powers are going to decline all that rapidly. They will at some point, clearly. But I can see her being very competitive, you know, this year if we get some racing, and certainly next year as well. Well, that was our special on Annemiek van Vleuten. I hope you enjoyed it. Something a little bit different this month. We'll do something different again next month, because we won't have any racing, of course. But we've got lots of ideas, haven't we?
We do. I'm not sure we've shared them with each other yet, but we've got lots of ideas. We always
They're
do.
They're all in here. They're all in here.
Up there for thinking, down there for dancing.
Well, they're in each of our
self-contained
bonces, I think.
Yeah, noggins. We'll clash them together virtually.
That's what, you know, Rose is down there by the seaside. I can just see her staring out into the over the horizon, thinking of ideas.
It's true. I was reading today that this is the area where Samuel Taylor Coleridge did a lot of his writing. So
pressure,
I should probably do a bit of that. It sounds like I'm going to segue into one of Orla's. Oh my God, what are they called? The Women's Tour.
Oh yeah, the literary
roundups,
yeah,
with
yeah,
all
yeah.
The references. But I'm not going to.
Because it's late.
Kublai Khan is a bit hard to sneak in somewhere. But yeah, so I will be inspired, and then I'll give you all of my amazing ideas like the day before, and then we'll have to just quickly put something together.
Well, we've got school restarting in a week and a half, so I've got no excuse for not having ideas by then. Oh, I may just sleep for a week, but once I wake up, I'm sure I'll be fully refreshed.
The ride of the ancient Mariana
Voss. I wondered why Richard went dead-eyed for a while there. Did you wonder that, Orla?
He was Googling.
I was talking and I was thinking he's gone completely dead-eyed.
To be honest, Rose, I realized it was just I didn't Googling. Notice the difference.
Oh. I like the peace and quiet.
I think the picture froze.
The picture froze just as he had that gormless look on his face. It wasn't that he continued with that.
Oh, well, anyway, it was worth a try. Well, good luck with everything. I hope you manage to stay on your bike, Orla, and get the kids off to school
safely. We didn't find out what you've been up to, Richard, other than being on your turbo trainer and eating cake.
Eating energy bakes. Yeah, I've been on my turbo trainer a lot, though. I mean, I've been riding my bike here far more than I would do normally, so I feel fitter. We've been doing weekly cycling podcast group rides on Zwift. We'll be using another platform again in the next couple of weeks for some group rides. And I have to say, they've been really great fun. We do them on Sunday mornings, and not something I'd ever done before or even really considered, but it's really good fun. It's really good fun. Not least because it's...
Because you win.
You know... No, yeah, no, no.
I was wondering who would do best. Certainly who does not. Best on the podcast rides?
I said rides, not races. Well, the fastest round the Innsbruck World Championship course, which of course we know well, Orla. Oof. It was Hannah Troop.
Amazing.
At the weekend.
Oh.
She went round even quicker than Lizzie Banks. But they weren't racing. Let's be clear.
The only time I've attempted any of that course was when I was pregnant on a hire bike. So I feel like I could at least beat my PB now.
Yeah.
If nothing else.
Yeah, I'm sure you could. We spent almost a week, didn't we,
beautiful.
In Innsbruck, going around on the bikes. A little bit different doing it on Zwift, but great fun, really good fun. And yeah, it's sort of just having a time, a meeting time, is quite useful, because otherwise. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, when you can jump on it and go whenever you want, you tend to not bother or put it off or things get in the way. So it's really good fun, actually. I really have enjoyed that. And I've been riding my bike a lot, and hopefully outside at some point. You can ride your bike outside here in the UK, but riding in London has never been my favourite thing.
It might be quite nice now, though, you know. If it's quite quiet.
Yeah. It's still riding in a city, though, and I'm not a huge fan. I like to ride my bike in the countryside.
I'm with
ideally.
You. I so. Hear you.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll gather again next month, which is just over a month away.
Thanks for the time reference.
I say that because we're right at the start of May.
We'll gather next month, which
I mean.
Last time I checked was about 4 weeks away.
It's going to be just over a month away.
So that will be June, yeah? Just so we're totally clear, that will be June.
It will be early June. Early June. It'll be just after our virtual Giro, which I'm sure all of you will be tuning into.
Wonderful. Can't wait.
In the meantime, thank you very much, Orla.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Val.
Thank you, Rose.
Cheers, both.